And Radio Derb is on the air. Welcome, listeners, here from your appropriately genial host, John Derbyshire, bringing you news and views on topics of the hour. Let's proceed directly to this week's big story, the Jussie Smollett hate hoax. Yes, the Jussie Smollett story has finally attained the point of total narrative collapse. Wednesday night, the Chicago cops charged Mr. Smollett with filing a false police report. That's a felony that could carry jail time. Jussie Smollett is out free on $10,000 cash bail. What a surprise. Among the many, many things illustrated by the Jussie Smollett case is this one. If you want a clear picture of what's happening in our society, you should ignore the mainstream news outlets and go to dissident right websites. If you can find one that hasn't been de-platformed, de-funded, de-twittered, de-youtubed, de-paypaled, de-facebooked, and so on. While mainstream journalists on 6- and 7-digit salaries were gasping, swooning, and clutching their pearls, giving unqualified credence to Smollett's story, we deplorable bigots out here on the unrespectable right were calling hoax. Our own Nicholas Styx, who, by the way, should you get the chance to meet him in one of our clandestine gatherings down in the catacombs, Nicholas Styx is a first-class journalist who would have been a household name back in the days when mainstream journalism meant something more than just parroting the cult Marx narrative. Nicholas Styx called hoax on January 29th, the very day the story was first reported. Steve Saylor expressed a guarded scepticism the following day. Quote from Steve, "This one is so absurd sounding that I'm wondering if it might not be true." End quote. As Steve went on to point out, Smollett's tale didn't sound at all absurd to big-shot media commentators and Democratic presidential candidates. They swallowed it whole. In my chosen lifetime mission as Sailor's Bulldog, I took a similar line in the February 1st Radio Derb, quote from me. "I'll allow that it might have happened. Probability in the range 2 to 5%, end quote. Steve and I were too cautious, and Nicholas Styx's journalistic instincts were correct. This was an obvious hoax from the start. Cautious as Steve and I were, though, with our credence down at that 2 to 5% level, we at least were not all in gullible, like the fools who populate our big media outlets and political campaigns. For them, it's narrative, narrative, narrative. Facts, probabilities, and precedents count for nothing. This is our society, an empire of lies." As far as my reading on the Jussie Smollett story has gone, I seem to be the only commentator striving to find some connection between Jussie Smollett and his only famous namesake, the 18th century Scottish novelist Tobias Smollett, who got a mention in that same February 1st Radio Derb. There are some mildly coincidental connections here, of the kind that would have pleased the late Arthur Koestler. Thus, in the following podcast, February the 8th, I noted the passing of British movie actor Albert Finney. What's the connection? Well, Finney starred in the 1963 movie Tom Jones, which was based on a novel by Henry Fielding, a coeval of Tobias Smollett. And no, coeval does not mean a person one has done evil things with. It means a person of the same age. For bookish young Brits of my generation, I was a freshman college undergraduate when the movie came out, Albert Finney as Tom Jones was a huge hit. It got us all reading the original novel. And then, having sampled mid-18th century picaresque fiction, we went looking for more, and we encountered Tobias Smollett. I personally didn't get very far along that road. I have a dim memory of reading Roderick Random and thinking it not as good as Fielding. Sir Paul Harvey's Oxford Companion to English Literature, my edition 1937, says that the story of Roderick Random is, quote, told with infinite vigour and vividness. Although Sir Paul later tells us that, quote, much of the story is repulsive. Well, I remember the vigour and vividness, but I don't recall being repelled. These vague recollections got me wondering if Tobias Smollett had anything to say that is relevant to the Jussie Smollett case. Having neither the time nor the inclination to read through the novelist's entire oeuvre, I pulled down my Oxford Dictionary of Quotations, the good old 1955 edition, not the crappy recent one. Poor old Smollett gets only 4 quotes in the Oxford book, and only one of them is relevant, though I must say it strikes me as relevant at a pretty high level. This is from Smollett's 1760 novel, The Adventures of Sir Lancelot Greaves. Quotation. I think, for my part, one half of the nation is mad, and the other not very sound. End quote. I find myself thinking that a lot. The Oxford book having left me dissatisfied, I turned to Benham's Book of Quotations, my edition, 1924. This gives Smollett much more space, 33 quotations. I note the following with some degree of relevance. Quote, the blast that blows loudest is soon overblown. End quote. That's like the higher you go, the harder you fall, which in fact does not necessarily apply if you belong to a protected class. Al Sharpton signed on to a hoax every bit as egregious as Smollett's, although to be fair, he didn't initiate the hoax. Rivermal ended up with his own TV show and an any time pass to the Obama White House. Jussie Smollett belongs to 2 protected classes, so there's a fighting chance he'll be vice president in the Kamala Harris administration. Another Tobias Smollett quote from Benham's. What though success will not attend on all? Who bravely dares must sometimes risk a fall. End quote. I'm not sure that the word brave can properly be attached to Jussie's stunt, when you consider the really brave things that cops, soldiers and many ordinary citizens do every day. But it was bold, I guess, if not precisely brave. Another Smollett quote. What foreign arms could never quell, by civil rage and rancour fell. End quote. Well, there's a possible epitaph for the USA. Another Smollett quote. Some folks are wise and some are otherwise. End quote. Very 18th century. But no less true for that. Another one. By this time, the demon of discord, with her sooty wings, had breathed her influence upon our councils. End quote. That's very good. The demon of discord, with her sooty wings, needs, as MCs say, no introduction in today's America. Another Smollett quote. The genteel comedy of the polite world. End quote. That phrase, the polite world, could usefully be revived to cover the world of politically correct mainstream media commentary and carefully orthodox politicians. The word comedy doesn't quite fit, though. Except that on a standard typewriter keyboard, the V is right next to the C. So, as Aldous Huxley noted, a slip of the fingers when typing the word comedy gets you vomedy. Now that fits. One more Smollett quote. True patriotism is of no party. End quote. Yes, another possible epitaph. Just a few random afterthoughts on the Jussie Smollett case. What's with Jussie? The name, I mean. Jussie? I never heard of a Jussie before. Fortunately, a kind listener looked it up for me. It is, of course, a diminutive for Justin, which name derives from the Latin adjective justus, which means just, equitable, fair. This listener, who will permit me to identify him only as, quote, a corporate lawyer hiding from political correctness, this listener, ruminating away in his safe space there, riffed on that at some length, making a connection with the Latin phrase, which he thinks he may have heard from me, fiat justitia ruat caelum. Let justice be done, even if the sky falls. Quote from my listener. To combine the two, as Mr. Smollett contemplates his reckoning, or what should be his reckoning, fiat justitia ruat justus. I guess my listener's idea there is, let justice be done, even if Jussie falls. Continuing from his email. Using the diminutive, fiat justitia ruat justulus. Or maybe you prefer the insincere superlative, fiat justitia ruat justissimus. End quote. I think we have a confusion of nouns, proper nouns and adjectives there. but I like the spirit of the thing. And I'd forgotten that Latin grammar includes a figure called the insincere superlative. Very handy, that. My listener follows up with a joke that I like even more. Joke: did you hear that Tawana Brawley and Jussie Smollett are forming a media company? It'll be called Brawley Smollett, or BS for short. Okay. I come at the story from my own settled perspective, which I have often aired here on Radio Derb, as a skirmish in the cold civil war between two big groups of white people who can't stand the sight of each other, with blacks pulled in as tokens and auxiliaries. Have you ever shared a beer with some friend or relative who's involved in a marital dispute, at loggerheads with the spouse over something or other? You're listening along sympathetically when there comes the point where he says something like, "You know, it wasn't really about what it was about." That's the way to see these periodic eruptions of outrage. From the Cold Civil War perspective, they are skirmishes between two huge groups of white people who hate each other. The two groups here are, one, the media, academic, political, and corporate establishment, who cannot forget nor forgive the outrage and humiliation they suffered in November 2016. And two, the 63 million Americans who inflicted that humiliation on them. Jussie Smollett, as Bob Dylan used to sing, only a pawn in their game. The demon of discord doesn't only have sooty wings, she has sooty pawns too. Sorry, my thoughts keep reverting to Tobias Smollett. What foreign arms could never quell, by civil rage and rancor fell. Well, there was our latest little episode of civil rage and rancor, the latest skirmish in our cold civil war. As the late Reverend Ian Paisley replied when a politician tried to calm him down in mid-rant by saying, "Come, come, Mr. Paisley, are we not all the children of God?" Paisley: "No, sir, we are the children of wrath." It would help lower the temperature of all this civil rage and rancor, or at any rate make black people less useful as pawns, if we could get some widespread acceptance for race realism. Sub-Saharan Africans and their descendants in the New World are a local variety of our species, Homo sapiens. That they present their own particular statistical profile on heritable characteristics, which includes traits of behaviour, intelligence, and personality, is deeply unsurprising. So do dog breeds. And what artificial selection in dogs has generated over a few hundred years, natural selection among humans could certainly accomplish in several hundred thousand years. That's all familiar stuff to Radio Derb listeners. Is there any chance of race realism taking hold in society at large? Not if the New York Times has anything to say about it. Currently defending the citadel of race denialism at the Times is one Amy Harmon, bylined as, quote, "A national correspondent covering the intersection of science and society," end quote. Ms. Harman recently contributed two pieces for The Times on the shortage of black mathematicians. February 18th, she profiled a black mathematician who feels he don't get no respect from his peers. February 20th, she expanded to a general theme about how bigotry, racial exclusion, unconscious bias, and so on, keep blacks out of math. I can speak with some modest authority to this. Touring around colleges to promote one of my math books 15 years ago, I could generally find, at any given college, I could generally find one member of the math faculty who was a kindred spirit and would speak honestly to me. I should explain, on the slight chance that there are listeners who don't know it, I should explain that American college faculties lean far, far left. I was working for National Review at the time, and I was introduced in colleges as a National Review contributor. That was too much for some of the faculty. They thought it outrageous that their campus should be blighted by the presence of someone from a bigoted, fascistic, hate-filled, neo-Nazi outlet like National Review. No, stop laughing. I'm not making this up. As I said, though, there was generally at least one closet conservative in the math department. At the first opportunity, he would invite me into his office, carefully close the door, pour me a drink, and unload on the particular variety of far-left campus craziness prevailing at his institution. To be fair to these poor beleaguered souls, their strongest frustrations were directed not at their colleagues, but at the college administration. As far-left as faculty generally are, college administrators are way farther. I heard some grisly stories. Well, I recall one of these guys, and yes, they were all guys, of course. I recall one of them telling me about his experiences on the hiring committee of the math faculty. The committee was under terrific pressure to hire a black lecturer, but it wasn't easy to find one because of the very tiny numbers of black math PhDs. He said, and I still remember the precise simile he used, he said the colleges fight like cats among themselves to get one of those precious blacks. In her February 20th article, Ms. Harman gives the number of black research mathematicians as 13 nationwide, out of a total of 1,800. So that's 0.7%. With blacks at 13% of the population, that is indeed a striking underrepresentation. This bigoted racist bias is not just American, it seems. It's worldwide. The math equivalent of a Nobel Prize is the Fields Medal, awarded to just 60 people since it started up in 1936. Not one of those people was black. Ms. Harman is scientifically illiterate about the causal factors here. She notes, for example, that there are people, bad people, horrid people, who posit biological reasons for the disparity. But, quote, they lack any genetic evidence to explain the gap in average IQ scores between white and black Americans that they cite as the basis of their belief. End quote. The answer to that is the one that Human Sciences blogger J-Man gives. Quote from him. You don't need to know the name of every worker in the factory to know that it produces widgets. End quote. Here's another piece of scientific dumbness from Ms. Harman. Quote, having a parent with a PhD is helpful to getting one in math, while black children are less than half as likely as white children to live with such a parent. End quote. Of course, science has no clue, not the faintest hint of a clue, no clue at all, as to what exactly it is that parents pass on to their children. Most likely it's nothing at all. Those zygotes emerge from conception as perfect little blank slates, right? Only Nazis think otherwise. Before leaving this topic, let me record my last encounter with a black mathematician. This was also while I was working at National Review. In the run-up to the 2012 campaign, when my coeval, Herman Cain, was in the GOP field, he dropped by to give us some face time, as GOP candidates all did. As well as having been born the same year as me, Cain has, like me, a bachelor's degree in math. He's smarter than me, though, and he went on to get a master's in computer science. Somewhere along there, he worked on math problems for the US Navy. I knew about this when I met him, so we had some math chat. What kind of problems had he worked on, I asked him. Ballistics, he said. Missile trajectories and such. Me. Lot of differential equations? He. Oh, yeah. Me, a bit sneakily. ODEs or PDEs? He. Mostly O's. If you don't understand that exchange, just take it from me. For ballistics, Kane's answer was the right one. I came away impressed with the guy. As impressive as that is in a politician, though, differential equations are mathematical grunt work. To be on the math faculty of a good college, you need to be a couple of levels above that. By a well-known property of the tales of distributions, which statisticians keep trying to explain, the proportional differences get bigger really fast out there at the extremes. Plus, being a math professor doesn't pay that well. If you are a black person with a math PhD, there are firms on Wall Street that will fight like cats over you, just like colleges will, but offering way more money than the academy. Amy Harman doesn't know any of this. She doesn't know any of anything much. Can someone please put the New York Times out of its misery? It used to be a very good newspaper. I remember my first encounters with it when I arrived on these shores back in 1973. I was impressed. You could spend all day with the Sunday edition, much to your advantage in improving your knowledge and understanding. Now, the Times is far gone in decay. Now it is just the propaganda organ of a shallow and false ideology. Come on, shut the wretched thing down. They shoot horses, don't they? And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. 17 days after Jussie Smollett staged his little play in Chicago, an employee at a manufacturing company 40 miles to the west in Illinois responded to news of his dismissal for discipline issues by shooting 5 fellow employees dead and wounding 1 other. When police arrived, he shot and wounded 5 of them too, until they managed to shoot him at last. The shooter, Gary Martin, was black. 4 of the 5 people he killed were white. The 5th was a Hispanic American. I don't know the races of the 6 wounded. I do know that if the shooter had been white and the 5 dead victims black, I'd be hearing about it until the day of judgment. Item. I confess I didn't know until this week that movie actor John Wayne has an airport named after him. John Wayne Airport in Orange County, California. And to judge from the website, it's pretty nice. It may not be John Wayne Airport for much longer, though. One of the mighty host of people now employed full-time searching through the documents and e-documents of our past for items to take offence at, one of these people turned up the interview that Wayne gave to Playboy magazine in 1971. Sample quote. I believe in white supremacy until the blacks are educated to a point of responsibility. I don't believe in giving authority and positions of leadership and judgment to irresponsible people. End quote. That was a pretty commonplace opinion 48 years ago. It's not even race realist. Wayne clearly thought that blacks could be and should be educated up to equality. It's too much for Los Angeles Times columnist Michael Hiltzik, though. He wants the airport renamed. Right after we've euthanized the New York Times, could we please get started organizing the independence of California? Item. Some errata. First erratum. Half a dozen listeners emailed in about the segment in my February 1st podcast advising listeners they not learn to code. That followed the mass layoff of journalists at outlets like BuzzFeed and HuffPo. The layoffs themselves followed by tweeters telling the laid-off journalists they should learn to code. One of my listeners edited, quote, "The recent use of that meme against cult Marx journalists is a payback for Obama and the left using it as serious," mockery quotes around the word serious advice to coal miners, etc., during the Obama administration. The alt-righters taunting these journalists didn't mean it seriously. They meant it to be mean. End quote. I honestly did not know that. Thanks to all who set me straight. Serious or taunting, though, learn to code is still lousy advice, for the reasons I gave. Item. Another erratum. A listener in Israel picks several nits with my February 15th comments on the article in The Economist about that country. Some of the nits are mine, some are The Economist's. The numbers for Palestinian Arabs, my listener notes, the numbers are gathered by the Palestinians, who have every incentive to inflate them. He seriously doubts, and he gives cogent reasons for his doubts, the Economist's figure of 7.2 million Arabs in the region in the year 2021. And he adds that whatever the number will be, it will include many non-Muslims, who have no great affection for their Muslim neighbours. I will gladly grant all that. But now, go look at the economists' maps of borders and jurisdictions on the West Bank, and tell me if you can that they show a rational, sustainable division of territory between two different mutually hostile peoples. That was my main point, and I stand by it. Item, just another point about doing math at the highest levels. Here was my experience, and talking to other people across the years, it seems to be a pretty common one. I went to a good English university back in the early 1960s, when they were way more selective than they are now. I studied math there for 3 years. No nonsense about majors and minors, just math 24/7. About 2 years in, I hit the wall. I mean, there were topics that I just couldn't master. Higher functional analysis, for example. It's true that I was not a good student, too easily distracted. But I am sure that even with maximum prolonged concentration, I would not have pulled off a first-class degree. I knew some classmates that did get firsts, and they were really, really smart. Grasping the essence of a problem and halfway to a solution while I was still struggling with the grammar. I eked out a third-class degree at last, but I've never convinced myself I really deserved even that. My engagement with math was in the nature of an unrequited love affair. I loved math, I still do, but it doesn't love me. Knowing I was never going to be a mathematician of any quality, I sensibly went off and did other things. I remember how supernaturally smart some of my classmates were, and the guys who taught us, one of them a Fields Medal winner. If you want to tell me, or if Amy Harmon wants to tell me, that some educational intervention, some pre-K program, some adjustment to my childhood environment, some tiger mom parenting, some 12-step program to raise my self-esteem, some nutritional regime, if you want to tell me that they could have made me as smart as those guys, and again, no offense, but they were all guys, if you want to tell me that, or Miss Harmon wants to tell me that, I can only respond with utter, jeering, hooting disbelief. That's all I have for you this week, folks. You can't say it's short on brain food. English literature, Latin grammar, higher mathematics. This is a class operation here at Radio Derb. Well, thank you for listening, and here's a phrase to take away with you. It's my phrase of the week. I got it from the Twitter feed of Melissa Chen, a very smart and attractive young lady from Singapore, tweeting about the Jussie Smollett case. Tweet. This case did not happen in an ideological vacuum. Toxic progressivism is turning the moral arc away from justice. End tweet. Toxic progressivism. That's my phrase of the week. To play us out, and with Ms. Chen in mind, here's a very nice bit of cultural appropriation. The song is one of Stephen Foster's best loved, and it's the state song of Florida, although they've had to revise the lyrics to make them cult Marx compliant. What's that got to do with Ms. Chen? Well, nothing directly, but I'm going to play it to you here, sung in Chinese. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.
故乡的情人，是我永远怀念。